Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, May 27th. Even in normal times, it might be weird to say that there couldn't be a safer place than a Las Vegas casino, but the governor of Nevada, Bob Sisolak, said exactly that last night as he announced a reopening for gambling and resort hotel stays for next week. He said, quote, "We will certainly be welcoming visitors back to Nevada on June 4th. We've taken every precaution possible. I don't think you're going to find a safer place to come than Las Vegas," unquote. But will the virus you get in Las Vegas stay in Vegas or spark new outbreaks when the tourists go home? That might depend on how effective the social distancing rules they will be opening with are. And that, of course, is just one example of businesses reopening that'll come with new rules. The big casino here in New York, known as the New York Stock Exchange, reopened for in-person trading yesterday with social distancing rules for the stock exchange floor. And at least one other that I've never heard before, no taking the subway to work. Did you hear this? I guess the Wall Street firms can afford to bankroll all those Ubers or whatever. As other businesses in New York get ready for reopenings, however, most workers obviously won't have that luxury. And as far as we know, Governor Cuomo, who rang the opening bell at the stock exchange yesterday, has no specific plan for the future of the MTA buses and trains. Neither did Mayor Bill de Blasio when asked about it yesterday.
We'll have a lot more to say on that in the next few days. But, you know, this is a crucial part of the equation. As I said, I don't see the restart happening until the first or second week of June. That's not far off. But we have certainly some days to work with the MTA, try and perfect these strategies. And then, as with everything else, to see how they're going and make adjustments as we go along.
With me now on reopening businesses and reopening your personal life, too, is Dr. Lena Wen, emergency medicine physician, George Washington University visiting professor, Washington Post columnist, and the former health commissioner of Baltimore. Her current Washington Post column is called Four Concepts to Assess Your Personal Risk as the U.S. Reopens. Dr. Wen, so great to have you with us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you very much, Brian.
Let's start with offices. I see you told a business webinar in Baltimore recently that they'll have to live with changes like no meetings in conference rooms, no more company kitchens or cafeterias, no lunch breaks with coworkers. How complete or blanket a policy do you think those things need to be?
At this point, we are reopening the country, even if a lot of us in public health do not think that we are ready to do so as safely as we should. The horse has left the barn. I mean, we are reopening, like it or not, even if we do not yet have the testing, tracing, isolation capacities and the steady decline in cases that we really should have before reopening. So the key now is recognizing that if we are going to reopen without these capabilities in place, there is going to be an increase in the number of infections. There is going to be increased risk. But there are things that we can all do as individuals, as employers, as policymakers in order to try to reduce that risk as much as possible. So the CDC has finally put out guidelines late, but at least they have put out some guidelines for helping businesses and others to do so as safely as possible. And I think that the most important thing that we can do is to try to get that physical distancing, the 6-foot distance, recognizing that indoor crowded spaces with a lot of people for a period of time, for a long period of time, that is the breeding ground for infection. So the more that we can cut down on that physical distancing, the better. And so that's why I'm recommending that when possible, that people should continue to telecommute, that people should stay away from congregate spaces like lunchrooms. And actually, you were talking earlier about public transportation. I actually do think that those who can afford to not take public transportation should find alternate ways to work, because that actually leaves more room on buses and trains for those who have to take those forms of transportation. It allows them to have more space. And ultimately, we recognize that social distancing is a privilege that not everybody has.
Since you went there to the mass transit question, I did look up CDC guidelines for reopening, which they have released with respect to buses and subways and commuter rails. And a lot of them are unrealistic, I think, for places like New York and the Baltimore, Washington area, like reconfiguring subways and commuter rails to have seats in rows, which I don't think you could do on the New York City subways. You can do it on the commuter rails. They already have rows. Roping off seats, marking where passengers should stand, and limiting the number of passengers per car. Some of those are quotes from the CDC website. Do you have any thoughts on best practices or how you can really protect people on the subways in very dense cities like ours?
Look, I do think that the capacity issue is really important. So again, those who are able to not take the subway, not take buses, should find alternate ways, should walk, bike, take Ubers, drive, because that then allows for more physical distancing for those who do have to take public transportation. And there are ways to protect ourselves as individuals as well. You can try as much as you can going during off hours. Make sure that you wear a mask, which protects yourself and protects others as well. Bring hand sanitizer with you, and so you're able to cleanse every time you touch communal surfaces. It's not ideal, right? I think that, again, everything that we do at this point has risk. If you're going to be interacting with other people, there is risk, but you can reduce that risk. Think about it also as cumulative risk too. Just because you have to go to work or take public transportation doesn't mean that you should also be going out to get your haircut and going to a restaurant and going to see your friends without protection, right? I mean, you should also be thinking about this as do the things that you have to do because it's for your livelihood and for your family. But otherwise, do your best to protect those around you. This is not the time to schedule, you know, dinner events and backyard barbecues and play dates for your kids. Reduce risk in as many parts of your life as possible during this time when the risk of transmission is so high still in our communities.
Reopening our personal lives. I'm looking at an article that features you on the NBC News website. So let me go down some of this list of points that you made there and ask you to expand on them. Visiting friends. Good news, you say. It's probably safe to see your friends if you maintain physical separation in an outdoor space like a backyard or a park. You want to talk about that a little bit? Because that's a step beyond only spend time with people in your household.
That's right. So again, there is the concept that we should mention of harm reduction, which is a public health concept that we in public health use a lot to say that, look, whatever you do is going to have a risk, but how can you reduce that risk as much as we can? We are going to be living with this virus for some time. Even if we get a vaccine in a year and a half's time, which is very optimistic, that's a long time for us to be living with the virus. We cannot not work or not socialize for a year and a half. And so the question is, if we're going to do these things, how can we do it as safely as possible? So think about three variables to determine risk: proximity, activity, and time. So the highest risk situation is in an indoor setting where you cannot practice physical distancing, where you are touching others, hugging, speaking loudly, sharing utensils, and if you're there for a prolonged period of time. That's the highest risk case. But if you want to see your friends more safely, do so in a backyard, in a park, where you can have that 6-foot distance. This is not the time to do handshaking, hugs, and kisses for greetings. Bring your own drinks, even bring your own chairs and food. Don't have a platter of food that people are dipping their hands into and sharing. Watch little kids too, because little kids are not so good at social distancing. I have a toddler, and there's no way that he would practice good physical distancing. And also, if you're going to, for example, a restaurant, which I would not advise going to a sit-down restaurant at this time, but if you really want to get food, again, takeout is much safer because you're there for a pretty short period of time. If you have to go somewhere, go and spend relatively less time there. Don't linger, because reducing that time of exposure is also really important too. So proximity, activity, and time.
Speaking of professions with close proximity, Looks like we have a dentist calling in. Rita in Somerset. You're on WNYC with Dr. Lena Nguyen. Hi, Rita.
Hi, Dr. Nguyen. Hi, Brian. You know, as dentists, we were all sort of not working. I work in a community center, and we were furloughed because of the, you know, danger from aerosols. I know that a lot of dental practices are reopening, but, you know, and they've all said that they're going to have an air purifier system and some kind of bacteriostatic coating. And in addition, you know, the providers are all wearing probably masks. I'm not sure if it's N95 and a plastic shield. I just wanted to, you know, find out how safe is this? I mean, is this safe enough for people to feel comfortable, patients as well as providers, you know? And do you have any kind of suggestions as how we could operate in a safe manner?
And I will say that's one of the categories that Dr. Nguyen addressed in her NBC News article, doctor visits in general. And how about dentist visits in particular, Dr. Nguyen?
Yeah, so it is very challenging. You know, healthcare continues to happen in the middle of a pandemic. And I know that a lot of people have been putting off their routine healthcare visits or even less than routine, even more urgent healthcare visits because of COVID. And now we're just getting back into doing elective procedures and people are getting back to, you know, doing things like childhood vaccinations and other things again. Dental visits are among the higher risk visits. And it's because of the amount of aerosol that's generated during procedures, even things like routine cleaning, and also because of the nature of that. It's different from giving somebody a vaccination. You're in people's mouths and being exposed to the respiratory droplets that way. So the CDC, again, has pretty thorough guidelines for how to, again, reduce risk. You're never going to get to 100% safety, 0% risk. But the CDC does have good guidelines for example, types of personal protective equipment and other things for dental providers. But I would say for patients who are looking to get on track with their other elective healthcare, there are other things that are safer and more necessary at this point than your dental cleaning and other routine dental procedures. Definitely get on track with childhood vaccinations, get on track with other medical procedures before you go back to your dental offices, because there is higher risk there than other places.
How about testing in the medical environment? Our previous segment was with the head of the American Federation of Teachers, Randy Weingarten, and she was actually advocating testing every teacher and every student every day. How far do you go?
I mean, if we are able to do that, if we are able to get to widespread testing, I could imagine that some type of regular testing, like what Randy was proposing, would give a lot of reassurance. But we need a lot of things to happen for that to be the reality. We need for the test to be accurate, at least for the test to have a very good reliability, so that a negative truly means that it's negative. You can't have somebody testing negative, but actually they're positive. Also, you need the test to be point of care. It needs to have a result very quickly, within minutes. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to let people back to school. And also, the test needs to be cheap. It needs to be ideally free, if not very affordable. Otherwise, how on earth are schools or workplaces going to be able to administer this test? We have fallen so far behind, Brian, in testing as a country. We have not had a national coordinated effort to begin with, which maybe at the time, back in February, one could excuse. But it's May. We've known for a long time that we need that type of widespread testing. We are nowhere near that, and we haven't even gotten an acknowledgement from our federal government that.
But is that the goal? Let's assume that we're building toward that, however too slowly. Is that the goal? Is that the future? Assuming no vaccine for a long time, let's assume that for the moment, for the sake of this conversation, assuming no vaccine for a long time, but that testing availability ramps up much faster than that. Are you talking about, since we had a dentist on, taking your COVID test every morning like you brush your teeth before you go to work?
That would be one way to get back to a normal life. It would certainly provide reassurance for workers, for students, for teachers. But if testing alone is not enough, you also have to have contact tracing. What happens if it's positive, right? You have to have a follow-up for quarantining those individuals who are exposed, isolating those who test positive. And again, there's so much more infrastructure to be built around testing that we just don't have yet.
Scott in Richfield Park, you're on WNYC. Hi, Scott. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi. That's just the subject of testing just brought something up, too. So two things. I was going to ask the doctor. So the virus, a virus like the cold virus or the flu virus or whichever you want to say is a virus, that spreads no matter what, correct? And we can't really stop it. And I'm guessing despite spending a month at home or not working, as soon as you go outside, you could be exposed to it, correct? Or am I not correct in that?
You are correct in that, that you go and interact with others, you have the risk of exposure. That's why we need to reduce that risk.
Right. So go ahead. You're building up to a point, Scott. Go ahead.
Okay. I was building up to a point. So, well, now the testing point. So if we don't have enough tests, right? We haven't tested 300 million people in the country. I mean, I'm not sure how many tests we've actually done, but it seems like the more testing we do, the less deadly this coronavirus seems to be. I could be wrong, and that's why I'm asking the question. But what if it turns out that this is less deadly than the flu or it's equivalent to that? Then what are we thinking? Then every time it's flu season, we're going to test everybody in the morning and we're going to separate everybody. Anytime it's cold season, we're going to do the same thing. I mean, it seems like we're getting a lot of misinformation from both sides. You know, some people saying, oh, it's not deadly, which it is. It causes pneumonia and things like that. But this is, I'm starting to see, or at least the numbers are suggesting that this was really, really overblown, except for places where we have amazingly mismanagement, like here in New York City and New York and in Jersey, where, you know, they've had terrible outcomes because we have high concentration of populations. And but the rest of the country doesn't seem to have that problem.
Scott, thank you. Let's get a response. There is a school of thought that goes like that, Dr. Nguyen. I'm sure you've heard it.
Yeah, and I mean, I appreciate the sentiment of where this comes from, but I think we need to talk about the facts of COVID-19, which is that it is not like the flu. It is at least 10 times deadlier than the flu. Even in countries that have widespread testing, we're finding these types of numbers as well. Also, even though this is a respiratory virus like the flu, it doesn't just affect the respiratory system, as we're finding out. We are seeing cases of young, previously healthy people in their 30s and 40s who are presenting with strokes, debilitating strokes from which they may never recover. And we're seeing young children have multi-system organ failure, toxic shock syndrome because of this. My colleagues in the emergency departments around the country, not just in New York City, but in many parts of the country, are now seeing upticks. And again, previously young, healthy people who are succumbing to this disease. And so we really have to take this very seriously with the humility of understanding that there's a lot that we don't yet know about COVID-19. And also that, yes, we need to reopen. We need to get people back to work. But again, there are things that we can do to reduce that risk for everyone.
Andy in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Brian. Hi, doctor. Thank you so much, Brian, for everything you do.
Thank you.
I have a question about daycares. The daycares will be open, I think, at least some of them, for essential workers next week. And are there any suggestions that doctor has for us to ask or to be ready to assess the risk? And I mean, kids at home are so tired and like bored, as you may know from your own experience. Do you have any specific suggestions that we should ask before we can send our kids to daycares? Really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I mean, daycares that are reopening have to abide by a very strict set of standards. So you should be asking about, I think the one question to ask your daycare provider is what protocols do they have in place, and get a list of those changes that they have. Then go to the CDC website and compare it to what the CDC has. I mean, it should look exactly the same, right? Or at least the daycare should at least meet those basic criteria. They might go above and beyond, but they should have these things. And it'll be things like reducing the classroom capacity and keeping children as much as possible separated, having toys that, or not having toys around unless they can easily be cleaned, and instituting new deep cleaning procedures, having children, making sure that they stay at home if there's any sign of illness, having staff also report their symptoms. There's an entire list that the CDC has. And again, I would ask your daycare for what they have in place and make sure that those lists align.
Another item that you address in your NBC News piece is beaches. And I think that we saw a lot of confusion, certainly in the New York metro area, with different beaches with different standards over Memorial Day weekend. So some beaches you can move, you can walk, and you can run, you can ride your bike near the beach, but you can't sit because the assumption is that you're going to wind up clustering. In New York City, Mayor de Blasio's policy was you can sit, you can bring a beach chair, but you can't swim. I'm not sure I understand why swimming becomes the unique risk. Maybe it was that that would prompt, again, more clustering, people coming in greater numbers if they could swim, and coming by subway, which you were recommending against before. So how about beaches as we head into summer season, since you address it in your piece?
Yeah, sure. I think there's some confusion about this because it sounds, from what you said, also the why is not clear, right? The why is it that we're saying no swimming, or in other places, why is it that they're saying no sitting? The why is you do not want to have people congregating. That's the key. There's nothing wrong with the water. You're not going to get COVID-19 from beach water or the pool water, and you're not going to get it from the sand, but you are going to get it from people sitting closely to each other, or people swimming closely to each other and breathing on each other. That's the problem. And so if you are able to sit, ideally for beaches, they're fine to go to if you can safely social distance. You can stay with your family and stay close to your family, but don't sit close to other people. If you're going and it looks like it's getting really crowded, come back another time, or just use the beach for exercise and keep walking, but don't linger. And again, if you're going with friends, do not share drinks, do not share a chair, do not share that space. And if you end up going, again, limit that time, because the time to exposure is also really important too.
One more call. Emily in Ocean Grove. You're on WNYC with Dr. Lena Wen. Hi, Emily.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Dr. Wen. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Great. So I'm in a relatively privileged position of being at a family beach house with my elderly parents, who both have pretty serious health issues, and we're trying to keep them safe. My other four siblings are all on the West Coast. Two of them want to come out in an RV, which we think is relatively safe. The other two are thinking about coming out by plane later in the fall. I think that the RV plan is a good one, and it will give my husband and I a chance to have a break and go back to our apartment in the city and take care of business. But I don't see why going by plane 3 months from now is any safer than it was 2 months ago. And I'd love to get your opinion.
So there is a risk, again, of flying and coming from somewhere else. I would advise driving rather than flying to try to reduce that, to reduce that risk. Once they come, they could self-quarantine for a period of time. I mean, to be really safe, you could self-quarantine for 14 days, and then everybody could be part of that bubble, if you will, together. That may not be realistic for a lot of people who don't have that period of time off, in which case you could try to reduce that time of quarantine. But again, any time you take shortcuts, you are increasing your combined risk. So it's something that you could do, but understand that there is going to be risk involved.
Emily, I hope that helps, and that's where we have to leave it. With Dr. Lena Wen, her current Washington Post column is called Four Concepts to Assess Your Personal Risk as the U.S. Reopens. She's an emergency medicine physician, George Washington University visiting professor, and has been the health commissioner of Baltimore. Dr. Wen, this has been helpful to a lot of people. I could tell from our phones. I hope we can do it again. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is obviously also a Daily Coronavirus podcast under the circumstances in our country right now. We'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York, or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.